The following program is produced and furnished in conjunction with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement, which is entirely responsible for its content.
Welcome to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. Off the Shelf gives a voice to commercial service and product companies selling in the federal market. Roger speaks to members and government officials about procurement policy trends, innovations, and debates. Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Now your host, Roger Waldron.
Today, my guest on Off the Shelf is Angela Stiles. Angela is the chair of Crowell Mooring LLP, a major law firm in here in Washington, D.C., with a great government contracts practice. And she's also the former administrator of federal procurement policy at OMB. Angela, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me here today, Roger. I appreciate it.
Well, I'm looking forward to the conversation. Lots going on out there right now in the federal marketplace. And as always, it seems like there's a lot of new rules out there and things going down or being introduced. And one that that's, I think, at the forefront right now that everyone is focusing on across both industry and within the government, because the implications and the ramifications of it, I think, will be so significant in the long run, is the fair pay and safe workplace, executive order, and then subsequently the Department of Labor guidance on it, and then now there's a proposed FAR rule out there. So it's a huge issue, and I think, and it's a great opportunity to talk about that. So I'm just going to start. Angela, you could tell us what's in this thing and what's the intent.
Absolutely. So last summer, the administration issued an executive order trying to deal with labor violations by federal contractors. So the intent of the executive order was to hold federal contractors responsible where they had significant labor violations and weren't currently being held responsible for those by being awarded contracts when the administration thought that they shouldn't be awarded contracts if they had significant labor issues. So a proposed rule came out about 3 weeks ago. Comments are due July 27th. So you have a proposed FAR rule, so guidance to the contracting officers as well as contract clauses, and then you have Department of Labor guidance. It is probably the most significant rule for the federal contracting system that I have seen in many, many years, largely because it puts a whole lot of burden both on the contractors and on the contracting officers. And it's much more expansive even than the executive order that we saw come out last summer. And to just give you a sense of what would be required by this proposed rule, if you want a federal contract or subcontract exceeding $500,000, you have to check off whether you have or have not had labor violations. Well, the problem is that the definition of what is a labor violation is incredibly expansive. It's not a civil judgment. It's not a final determination. It can be an administrative merits determination by one of 10 or more federal agencies that might even just be a letter that was issued to a company. So very significant reporting requirement. If you check the box, yes, that you have one of these, then you have to supply the contracting officer with what I will call a truckload of information, not just about the labor violation, but the mitigating circumstances, why you think that you're still a responsible contractor and should be awarded the contract. And then the contracting officer has the advice of a new person called a agency labor compliance advisor, who's supposed to take a look at the truckload of information.
The LCAs, right? That's
ACLA. And then the contracting officer, you're telling these poor contracting officers that already have way too much to do that they have to look at, you know, multinational corporations' issues regarding to labor, lawsuits in progress by multinational corporations, and make a decision about whether they are a responsible contractor or not. But what's really interesting about this rule is that once the proposed rule came out, as opposed to the executive order, is that I think you got to see the actual intent here. So there's a new term of art in both government contracting and labor law called a labor compliance agreement. And you can be a responsible contractor if you're willing to negotiate and settle different issues with all this slew of federal agencies that deal, whether it's the NRLB or whether it's the Department of Labor Wage and Hour or OFCCP. If you're willing to enter into the new labor compliance agreement, which is not a legal term of art, not found in regulations anywhere, if you're willing to enter into those, then you'll be more likely to be found to be a responsible contractor. So not to use an explosive term, but it's more like blackmail. It's blackmailing contractors into settling labor issues in order to get federal contracts is the intent of the rule as we see it right now.
So, wow, there's a lot there, Angela. One thing that strikes me about it too, along these lines, is from what you've described, it's a situation where, you know, once again, the procurement system is being used for something other than acquiring the goods and services that the taxpayer ultimately and the customer agencies need to actually accomplish agency mission.
I think if you talk to somebody from the current Department of Labor or from the administration, they would say that we'll get better services and we'll get better products out of companies that don't violate the labor laws. And you don't want companies that are violating labor laws to be,
absolutely,
you know, so there is a piece of that. So it's not saying that if you're a big labor violator with serious violations, that you shouldn't be held accountable for those. But the problem is that it's such a broad definition in the proposed rule that companies who really don't have serious issues, not willful, not pervasive labor issues, things that are not fully litigated, not fully decided, could keep you from getting a federal contract. And so they are using the federal contracting system to negotiate out more labor agreements, deal with more labor issues at all of the different federal agencies that deal with labor issues.
Right. So the agency LCA is the agency
labor compliance advisor. Yes.
Okay. Is that a single position? How is that supposed to play out at the various entities? Are we talking every activity has one? Like, I'm just trying to think, if it's the Department of the Air Force, for example, is there one for the entire organization, or are there going to be multiple positions?
They haven't said. Okay. I mean, you assume that there are going to be enough of these that have to be considered, and every contract has to be considered individually.
Over 500,000.
Every single one. So let's say you're a large company. Let's say you're Boeing, right? And you go in for one contract at the Air Force, and let's say, you know, I have no idea whether they do or not, but let's say they had to check yes, right? We have some administrative merits determinations. And they take the information in, and the decision is made by that contracting officer. Well, let's say they have something over at the VA. Well, that person has to make a decision, or somebody else, and they have to give them the same information, and they have to make an individualized decision. It's the only way that they can make a rule that will survive legal scrutiny in the courts, because they can't overtake the suspension and debarment process.
Right, like became de facto debarment.
Exactly. Right. So you think about it. If you're a big company, every single contracting officer, you're going to have to present these facts, and the contracting officer is supposed to make an individualized determination on each one with the help of the ACLA.
And is there also, well, even when you're awarded the contract too, right? It's an ongoing responsibility to report.
And then you're also supposed to be getting this data from your subcontractors. And what I find particularly difficult is that there are plenty of small businesses that are prime contractors that subcontract to very large businesses to get the work done, right?
Right.
So you're telling these small businesses that they're supposed to be getting labor information, labor violation information from the largest companies in our country or the world, and making a determination about whether that big business is a responsible contractor. It just doesn't work.
Right. And any large company, any company is not going to want to say, here's all my information about all these issues anyway.
Here, a five-person small business. Let me
Or any company. Here, you can take a look at this kind of information. It may be publicly available, but here, laying on a silver platter for another company to look at, even if you're partnering with them as a subcontractor. How does this, it's an interesting dynamic we're in right now. And how does it sort of, there's a lot of conversation right now, I think, to the credit of OMB, about trying to simplify the process, make it more efficient, adopt commercial practices again. The December 4th memo from OFPP used language that is very positive in a sense about streamlining and that sort of thing, and listening to industry and that sort of thing. So how does this juxtapose to that?
From my perspective, it's completely inconsistent. I mean, it brings into the incredible bureaucracy and burdens like I've never seen with another rule into the federal contracting process. So how do you, on the one hand, say We're trying to be more contractor friendly. We're trying to be more efficient. We're trying to do this better. We're trying to save taxpayers money, but at the same time be pushing this. I mean, I understand the desire to have good companies do business with the government.
Oh,
everybody wants that, right?
Yep. Yep.
But that doesn't mean that you add an incredible burden to the contractors. But honestly, this is a huge burden to the contracting officers. I wouldn't want to be a contracting officer if this is what my job was suddenly had to be.
Right. You're now labor sort of
authority.
Yes. That's a good way to put it. And I just, you know, in terms of cycle time and how long it's going to take to award contracts when you have to go through this kind of analysis, in addition to best value trade-offs and, you know, evaluation of proposal. I mean,
I can't even imagine. I haven't actually gone back to the public data to see how many, you know, contracts. And they did say in the rule that it's contracts as opposed to task orders. So that's helpful because the executive order did not clarify that. But I haven't gone back to see how many contracts over $500,000 there are a year to get a better sense of magnitude. Yeah. But I'm sure it's
somebody will.
Yes,
somebody will.
Exactly.
Right. So, Angela, we do have to take our first break. When we come back, we'll be talking more to Angela Stiles. She is the chair of Crown Mooring LLP and former administrator for federal procurement policy at OMB. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit at a related topic, you know, suspension and debarment, what's going on, some trends in that area, and what Angela's telling her clients when they're dealing with that kind of unfortunate situation. You're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
This is an important time for the federal government, a chance for agencies to do things differently. How will you help shape your future? Turn to Deloitte. With our private sector insight and public sector experience, we'll help you rethink, reduce, and restructure, and turn resolve into results, so you can see what's possible and make it happen. See how at Deloitte.com/federal. Wherever you need to go, Deloitte sees you there.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Today, my guest is Angela Stiles. Angela is the chair of Crown Mooring LLP, major government contracts practice, amongst other things, here in Washington, D.C. and around the country and the world. And Angela also served as administrator for federal procurement policy, and currently you do a lot of work in the suspension and debarment area, and you follow that, and I've read several of your articles that you've written about it. So I'm just going to open it up and you can start talking, because that was easy enough the first segment. So, Angel, what's going on in the suspension and debarment? What are you seeing?
So I think what's important about the suspension and debarment world is the trends that it shows about contractors and the government. So a lot of times issues arise because of something that's transacted between the contractor and a government official. And so you get to start to see what are the issues that are most difficult for the industry, for the government contracting industry. What are contractors and government officials really struggling with in terms of ethics and compliance issues? And I think what we're seeing, and this is based on a lot of conversations with the suspension and debarment officials themselves, they're seeing small businesses have a really, really hard time with the rules and regulations that they have to follow in order to be a prime contractor or in order to be a subcontractor. And they're just very concerned that there aren't enough resources out there to really help small businesses understand their legal and ethical obligations when they become a contractor. And they want help because they see businesses that didn't intend to get into trouble really getting, they see good businesses and good people that they have to debar because they didn't have the resources, they didn't understand the arrangements that they were getting into. I think another important area that they're seeing is that in the acquisitions, that there's a lot of companies out there that have great technology that are being acquired by larger companies that have terrific ethics and compliance programs. And they're seeing some companies that are really, really good at acquiring these startups, if you will, who've become really big government contractors over time, and inculcating like the right ethics and compliance and making mandatory disclosures once they acquire them, when they find issues that arose because they were the small business that didn't necessarily know all the rules and regulations, but they had great technology.
Right.
And so they're seeing a lot of issues in that area. You know, generally they are also focusing on the mandatory disclosure process, contractors actually filing mandatory disclosures, understanding their requirements to, when you find something at your company, to disclose it to the inspector general and the contracting officer.
Well, on mandatory, what's your assessment of how that rule is sort of played out in terms, has it increased the amount of money the government's recovered, or is, I mean, what, how do you measure objectively whether it's improved things or not? Or, and perhaps you already had a particular view on the rule to begin with.
Well, I can't believe I would ever say this, because when the rule came out, I thought it was a horrible idea. I thought it really changed the dynamic between the government and contractors and whose roles and responsibilities were whose, right? But I have to tell you, the federal government largely has handled this incredibly well. When a contractor comes in and makes a disclosure, they work with them. They figured out the appropriate settlement. They don't tend to penalize them or punish them for it, because they realize that they're trying to improve, that they're trying to be a good company. I have not had a bad mandatory disclosure. I know other people have, but I will say in some agencies I have more confidence in than others in terms of how the disclosure will be handled, how the company will be treated, how they will improve and become a better company because of the disclosure and because of fixing the issues that were found. So overall, it actually, I think, has worked pretty well.
Right. And well, isn't that part of the, really what you're talking about there is that, that those agencies are doing a good job with that. It's the, I mean, it can't, if it's going to be mandatory, it can't be perceived as so a quote punishment or so painful to go through that I'd rather not disclose than do, you know what I mean? There's a balance there, right? If you're trying to encourage people to do the right thing, you can't just hammer them, you know, when they do the right thing, right?
But I think everybody thought that that was what was going to happen, right? Everybody thought that once we started disclosing something that we were going to not be treated well, that we were going to be, you know, you know, that there were going to be high fines and penalties, lots of, you know, public discussion about the issues. And it really has been handled incredibly, the agencies I've worked with, very appropriately to come to the right resolution to get the money back to the government that needs to go back without really penalizing the company for what occurred.
Right. And to me, that's a great story. And it's more of a sophisticated or a nuanced approach to understanding what the dynamic is between the contractor and government and how to get to where they both want to get, right?
Exactly. But I was surprised. I didn't think a mandatory disclosure rule would be able to get there, but the people and the IG's offices have really been quite good for the most part at most agencies with figuring out how to do this appropriately and reach the right resolution for both sides.
Right. So a question on, you mentioned this, you know, department officials seeing small businesses, I guess it sounds like it's a growing trend of who don't understand the rules or are good people, but they just, you know, said, I don't know what I'm supposed to do with that. So they don't do anything, and that can be the worst thing to do. Do you get any sense that might be, and I don't say the right word, it's an unintended consequence or a consequence of the emphasis now over the last few years on contracting with small businesses, like whether it's the new set-aside rules for multiple boards, just increasing opportunities for small businesses. It's both a legislative and executive branch like focus that increased opportunity has brought maybe a little less sophisticated small businesses into it.
I think it's a direct consequence of the push to do business with more small businesses without really having the resources in place to help them understand what their obligations are. I mean, I certainly think it falls squarely, if you ask me, on the SBA to do this, right? I have, on behalf of some large businesses, been trying to work with the SBA to come up with some programming, just basic programming for small businesses so that they don't fall into these traps. Nobody wants them to not perform the contract in accordance with the terms and conditions, to end up before a suspension or debarment official, or to end up having their contract terminated. But they just need resources in order to understand those requirements, because they don't have them internally and they're not going to be able to build them internally. But it's largely, I have to say, I've been so disappointed how it's just fallen on deaf ears. Like, there's a lot of people in industry and a lot of large companies that want to help. And I think they have great programs, mentoring programs and things like that. But to reach the small businesses, I think requires the SBA.
Yeah. Well, I've got an idea for you. You know, believe it or not, GSA does a lot of training on use of its programs, like for the schedules. Then the training is free. They do webinars. They do all kinds of training. Perhaps there's an opportunity for the SBA and GSA to team together to roll out some training. 80% of the contractors on the GSA schedules are small businesses, right? And they use the schedules as often as an entree point to the federal marketplace. So, you know, and they do a lot of training on how to prepare offers and those kind of things for small businesses. But maybe there's an opportunity there to develop some sort of training that would support, you know, small business compliance programs too.
I think it would be great. I mean, everything from just a basic code of conduct and ethics to just basic policies and procedures, knowing what the gift rules are, knowing what the revolving door rules are. People just fall into the traps of a small business, and it doesn't take that much to train them. It would be fabulous if GSA could work with SBA, because they're all I hear is a crying need out there to help people so that we don't end up in this situation.
Right. Well, you know what? We're already up on the next break, Angela. My guest today is Angela Stiles. She is the chair of Crown Mooring LLP's entire firm. Hey, and she is also former administrator of OFPP. And when we come back, we'll talk about the state of commercial item contracting, where it's going. Also talk about efforts to make the procurement system more efficient and effective in other areas, as opposed to the fair pay and safe workplace guidance that's out there, which we discussed earlier in the show. You are listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today, my guest is Angela Stiles. She's the chair of Crown Mooring. She's also former administrator of federal procurement policy at OMB. And we've been talking all kind of, you know, new regulations that are, or proposed rules that are out there. We're talking suspension and debarment. And, you know, this segment, let's start off, Angela, with the state of commercial item contracting. You know, as a, you know, the Federal Acquisition Streamlining Act of 94 and then Clinger-Cohen Act of 96. There's a lot of reform in the 90s. And then from my perspective, you see a lot of sort of sometimes slow, sometimes very rapid, like ratcheting back or the pendulum, the cliche, the old pendulum has swung away from that sort of approach. I just wonder what your thoughts on where commercial item contracting is and how well, and part of that question is how well is the federal government accessing the commercial marketplace? And there's another piece to that. See, I'm adding all these pieces. It's a compound, multiple question. Because there's a lot of talk about innovation. And now we need access to innovation. Like, we need innovative companies to do business with the federal government. And I think a lot of that is you got to make it easier to do business. And that was commercial item was all about. So after that long introduction, I'm going to let you talk about it. Go ahead.
So I think for a number of reasons, the pendulum has swung over so far that I'm not sure there's really commercial item contracting anymore. The terms and conditions that are required to do business with the government are nothing like the private sector. And I deal with a lot of businesses, a lot of large businesses that do provide commercial products and services, and they sure don't think those terms and conditions are anything like what they deal with in the private sector. And I think the reason is, so there were reasons, right? So there were 200% profit on, you know, spare parts, and there were all kinds of issues with how broadly people tried to define commercial items, which I think led to the clampdown, if you will, on what is a commercial item. But today, there aren't really commercial item contracts, because when you provide a commercial item, they dig really deep into the pricing, whether you're the prime contractor or whether you're down in another tier. So in some perspective, it's like, what difference does it make, right? So you sell the product for $200 in the private sector, they don't seem to care. They want to dig really deep into how the price was developed and whether that's the appropriate price for the government. Commercial item contracting is, what can I go buy it at Home Depot for? And if I sell it at Home Depot for $200 and I make a 200% profit on it, then I'm going to sell it to the government for the 200% profit. The government's not, they're just flat out not willing to accept that scenario. They want it at 10% profit or less, and they want to make sure that that's what they're getting. So you don't really have commercial items anymore, and it's, you really don't have them below the prime contract level.
Right. Well, that's, you know, to your point is that, I mean, when you look at, you know, DOD in a particular in services, right, the idea that cost reimbursement, knowledge-based service contracting is preferred method, you know, to the extent you can't define it to do it from a fixed price, is a reflection of that, right? It's all about margins and like what the profit rate is on a labor hour, right? And that way, that's a way to control it,
That's exactly right. That's the way they've decided that they're going to squeeze companies in terms of the prices that they're charging. I mean, it's almost as if everything is cost reimbursement contracting, because they want to delve into, whether you're a prime contractor or a subcontractor, what your profit margin is. I mean, every request that they have out there is to make sure that they understand the profit margin, so they think that they're getting a fair price. And what is that but cost reimbursement contracting?
Right. So the role of competition in that context?
Okay. Well, you know, it has a lot to do, I think, unfortunately, with people are just not playing. Like a lot of people, I mean, the role of competition in that context is, from my perspective, that a lot of companies, be they small, innovative companies, or the large companies that provide products and services, don't want to play in that environment. Why would they? Why would they want to participate in an environment where the government's asking them what their profit margin is?
Right. Or even, you know, I think another area where this sort of manifests itself, whether it's a direct profit margin issue or just trying to drive pricing down, is in the GSA schedules context, there's a lot of horizontal pricing that's going on and comparisons there. And it really raises the question about what does the contract price mean on multiple award contracts? Is that something that your clients or you see out there, that really we have a multiple award contract, but the competition's at the task order level? What?
It has no meaning. Right. I mean, so negotiating the price at that level has no meaning, because you know you're going to have to
compete at the order arena,
and you're going to be driving down the price, and it's, you know, some will stick it out, right? Because they want the business and they need the revenue, and the revenue is really important to them, even if they aren't making great, you know, profit margin on the revenue. But it's a impossibly difficult world to compete in, I think.
So if you were back in your old position, let's say you could make some changes to the system to try to improve it or to get access, let's say, to the innovative companies. You know, where are there opportunities where changes could be made that could improve the system?
We need real commercial item terms and conditions. And we, you know, it's almost like we're back to the 90s, right? Get rid of the certifications, being serious about going out to the marketplace for what is commercial, because so many things really are commercial. And right. There's just many people that don't really want to participate. I mean, I think we just miss out on a lot of good and innovative technology. Sometimes the larger companies will go out there and buy them because the technology is so good, but individually, they don't really want to do business with the government. So I think figuring out a way to truly do commercial item contracting, if you will, to really have like commercial-like terms and conditions when you're buying real commercial items. I don't mean things that aren't actually commercial items, right? But real commercial items would make a big, big difference. And I think all you see is continued rules. And so instead of having trust and confidence between the government and the contractor, we just get more rules. Like, so something happens and you get another rule and you get another regulation. And it's, you know, look at the books, look at the FAR. How big can they get? Like, I can't, you know, they're on my iPad now, but I can't, you can't carry them around.
Well, you couldn't carry them around. No, absolutely
it's
not.
It's just too hard, right? It's just too hard to understand what they mean and to operate in that. Even the largest of companies has a really hard time keeping up with the new rule, the new regulation, how a particular agency is interpreting it. It's just crazy. It's almost like you wanted to start from scratch and say, what's a good contracting system to start with?
Well, it is. And your last point, that's overhead, right? That's, you know, that's all cost of doing business with the federal government. That, and I like to look at it from this perspective. It just seems like the overhead part is getting bigger and bigger, and the money that the taxpayer would want to go to directly to, you know, directly on performance of the work to be done for whatever agency mission, you know, whether it's NIH trying to, you know, cure cancer or whatever, that portion is getting small. We can't afford that.
You're just driving up the overhead. And the hardest part that I see in the interactions between contractors and the government is when the government, contracting officers, policy people don't actually understand the cost burden issue. There are true monetary costs every time you add a certification, every time you add a new rule. Most companies, they want to comply. They want to understand.
Absolutely.
They want to put processes in place to make sure they're doing it the right way, but it costs money. And that money only comes back to the taxpayer.
Right. So what you're saying, there's power in simplicity.
Yes.
Right. Well, yeah, we already are up to the next break, Angela. So when we come back, we're going to be talking more to Angela Stiles. She is the chair of Crown Warring and former administrator for federal procurement policy at OMB. And when we come back, I'm going to let Angela tell us a little bit about the legal market out there, what's going on, what she's seeing from clients and in her role as chair of the firm. You are listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Today, my guest is Angela Stiles. She's the chair of Crown Warring and former administrator of federal procurement policy at OMB. And, you know, Angela, before we talk about, you know, the practice of law sort of generally and what's going on in the marketplace and what you're seeing in your role as a chair of the firm, I wanted to go back to what you're talking about, commercial item contracting and the burdens and overhead and all that kind of thing. And there's another area, interesting, you know, recent rule that's been proposed. Like I said, there's one rule after another here. It's GSA's proposed transactional data reporting rule, which would require contractors to submit, you know, transactional data on a monthly basis, all their orders, the pricing, the description requirement, part number, all kinds of data elements. And in exchange for that, GSA was going to waive application of the price reduction clause tracking requirement as I guess quid pro quo sort of thing in exchange. Do you have thoughts on that rule?
I think most people would rather just stick with the current system than switch to one that just seems incredibly burdensome in terms of reporting. You can keep track of your tracking customers and decide when price reductions are required. And everybody has those systems in place. Not everybody doesn't like it. I'm not going to say everybody would love to keep that rule. But this one just seems an extraordinary burden to track the transactional data. And from a legal perspective, you have to get it right. That information has to be correct. So good companies are going to spend an extraordinary amount of time to make sure the data is right, because it's either a false claim or a false statement potentially if you aren't putting enough effort into it to get those numbers right. And I think there's just a disconnect. I'm not sure that the government understands how much effort companies put into it to get it right so that they're not subject to potential false claims.
Right. And when you talk about GSA schedules, you talk about, you know, many companies, you're letting tens of thousands of orders, even on a monthly basis, theoretically possible. And hundreds of thousands over the course of a year, and that, you know, the amount and the investment in that, you know, as I mentioned to you, we did a survey of our members of it, and it's it's in the hundreds of millions of dollars of increased cost just to implement the rule.
Well, last time I looked, they were supposed to be commercial item contracts, right?
Right.
The GSA schedules,
very good.
Right?
Very
so,
good.
I mean, last
yes.
time I looked at it, they yeah. were supposed to be, and I can tell you, there are no such requirements in the private sector that I've ever seen.
Okay. I appreciate that. So, and another piece of it, the rule, just your thoughts, is that although they waived the price reduction clause, there's this statement throughout the rule about, you know, maintaining the GSA reserves the right to, ask for updates to the commercial sales practices information that contractors submit to negotiate the contracts up front. What does that mean from a sort of Civil False Claims Act and just contract compliance requirement?
Well, I think GSA doesn't understand how hard it is to properly put together a CSP. So you are looking at everything to put together your CSP, and it is a one-time negotiation document so the government can understand what it is that they're buying and the price that they should be buying it at. And obviously, when you add new products, sometimes they ask for it, and I think that's a reasonable thing just for the products that you're adding. But to ask for an update, that's not the basis of what these contracts were supposed to be. And it takes so much time. I just can't tell you. I mean, we're talking about big commercial companies with lots and lots and lots of products. It takes a lot of time to sort through, oh, we offered that one because it was a five-year deal and we offered a discount here. So that really explaining each and every one in your commercial sales practices form on a more regular basis, that's an extraordinary requirement that I just don't think they know what they're asking for.
Yeah, and it is that potential Civil False Claims Act still ongoing if they maintain that. It's so a company's just going to be a new overhead element Right.
And the issue with the False Claims Act is you can have the government say, oh, well, that's okay. We're fine. You don't have to be that careful. But you have private individuals out there that are relators and whistleblowers.
Yep.
And and so you're protecting yourself against them, not against the government necessarily coming after you.
Right. So, well, that's a good summary of the rule from my perspective. But so let's turn to, you know, the practice of law, and your role as chair of Crowell Mooring, you know, what's going on in the marketplace? What are you seeing in terms of how, you know, firms are navigating and dealing with their clients? What are the clients? How have things changed? And even specifically in the government contracts area, what are you seeing?
I think it's very dynamic in the legal marketplace, and dynamic and very competitive. And what you're seeing is what you're also seeing in the economy. So you have brick and mortar companies, right? And you have historic brick and mortar companies that operate in a certain way and are learning to deal with disruptive technologies and trying to survive, right? And they have lawyers that practice law in a particular way that we all grew up and learned how to practice law together, right? But then you also have the more dynamic new economy companies, if you will, and their in-house counsel are on call 24 hours a day. They have incredibly stressful jobs. They are also government. Many of these companies are also government contractors, but they are operating in a very, very different way than I think you've seen our historic brick and mortar companies, particularly in the U.S., operate. And their demands on their in-house counsel are different than the demands on the in-house counsel of a traditional company. And you see a new generation of lawyers, I think, growing up around the new economy and companies that want you to really understand their business, want you to be there with them, want you to share the risk with them. They want you to look at a contract and tell them, what are the three top issues that I need to worry about? As opposed to, I will tell you, a traditional company would say, cross every T, dot every I, I want to know every potentiality here. Well, if you're a new economy company, you don't have time for that.
Right, it's too dynamic, right?
It's just too dynamic. You will be gone, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you are actually demanding that of your people or of your lawyers. And so you're seeing a different generation of lawyers. Some people love it. I think it's a more stressful practice of law because there's more risks involved, because I'm used to crossing every T and dotting every I, right? I'm used to having the time to doing the research so I can give you a full analysis of what your risks are. But they're wanting you to share the risk with them. They're wanting you to understand their company. They want you to answer the phone at 1 a.m. I mean, there is, you know, they expect you to be side by side with them. I think we're seeing the traditional companies start to change because they know that to compete, to really be here 5 years or 10 years from now, that they're going to have to become more dynamic that way. You also see people figuring out how to cut costs too. So the new economy companies live and work all over the world, right? Their people, sure, some of them have different facilities in different places, but they have people all over the world that are learning to work together without having to sit in the same room. You're seeing the same thing in law firms. You know, we're learning how to live and work in hotel and not have to be down the hall from the senior partner that yells, hey, come down here. So
we are learning
with our clients, and we're also learning how to, you know, recruit differently, you know, to bring people in, train them, and send them to our clients. Literally recruit them out of law school and say, the best place for you is with our client, and just building that long-term relationship with them. That's really different than the past, I think.
So what I'm hearing too is that technology has fundamentally changed. Well, not only, you know, you have the new economy, but just how you advise your clients in a certain sense, right? When you're talking about 24 hours a day, like companies are set up so that they are working literally 24 hours a day, right, around the globe, right?
That's exactly right.
So, one thing that I thought about when you were describing it is, I think it's an interesting dynamic. Is, you know, the hoteling concept, or the person down the hall, the partner calls you down. How are you seeing it work? Because one of the things that I always found very beneficial, and actually one of the most fun things practicing law, is like you sit down with your co-counsel that you're working on a case, and you're in the same room, and you're sitting there saying, you know, well, what about this word? You know, you're literally going word by word. You're talking about the arguments. You're exchanging ideas. Well, what about what if they say this, or this? Here's this argument. Have we thought of that? And that kind of intellectual sort of face-to-face conversation. How is that taking place still, or how is that accomplished?
It is still taking place. I will say, as technology's gotten better, much of it can be video-based. So it's hard to get used to, right? It's hard to get. Some companies are really good at it, I have to say. Some, you know, have up on their screen all of their people. They'll have 10 people in a conference and you'll see all of their faces on the screen. I mean, technology allows you to do it. You have to, A, buy the technology, but also get used to operating with that technology. So I'll say, I think the clients are further along with this. And so we're coming along with them, getting used to the technology and working together by video, but knowing when you need to be together too. I mean, it's actually really important to know when you need to collaborate in person, because there is a difference still.
Yeah, so that made you just think about, you know, being in the, when I worked in the government, like meetings. There's meetings all the time, right? Didn't we ever really need all those meetings? Of course, you know, you were there.
I had to do my work after six because all the meetings I had all day long. Yes.
So, that's an interesting point too. Just the comfort level with the technologies and being able to have the same conversation, only you're looking at the screen and the person you're talking to is your co-counsel on a case, and you're having the same arguments that you would. I think it does. I mean, if you've grown up that way, it's probably, you know, just like, you know, water rolling off your back. But if it's like someone who's my age and getting used to it a little bit.
Well, it's just like we all used to draft by hand, okay?
Right,
we all used to write on
That's
a piece of paper
point.
By
That's
hand,
That's a great
right?
point. I can't write anything anymore with a pen. I got to use my keyboard.
Exactly, and you learned over time. You couldn't write by hand now if you wanted to, right? You draft on the computer. So I do think it is a matter of people getting used to the technology and using it, but knowing when you need to be there in person too.
Right. Well, unfortunately, we're out of time, Angela. I want to thank my guest, Angela Stiles. She is the chair of Crowell & Waring and former administrator of federal procurement policy at OMB. And you've been listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.